Now I want to switch over to your time with the president, because I found this is fascinating. Within the story of the war is the story of a family and the story of a young analyst. And as you write on page 26, if you are a young CIA analyst, your dream job is to be the daily briefer of the president. You started in December of 2000. You went with him through the worst day of the country since Pearl Harbor, 9/11. And of course, you stayed with him through the end of that year. Wow, what a crushing, brutal burden. I mean, on the president, but you were up at what, 3 o'clock, 12, 2:30, 2 in the morning every day?
Yeah, so before 9/11, I got up at 3 to get to work at 4 for an 8 o'clock briefing. And after 9/11, I got up at 12:30 to get to work at 1:30 for an 8 o'clock briefing. So, yeah, it was tough.
I've done morning radio, but when do you go to bed?
So, you know, I was kind of lucky because my kids were very small at the time. So I kind of went to bed when they went to bed. You know, I actually was a good job for that because I actually spent more time with them than I would have otherwise.
Well, that part makes sense to me. 15 minutes after you left Barksdale on 9/11, the president asks you bluntly for your best guess. You told him, I haven't got any intelligence yet, but you said Al-Qaeda, because Iraq and Iran are the only other two state actors that could do this, and neither has much to gain, and both had plenty to lose from attacking the U.S. This is a hard question. Iran is run by, in part, end-time fanatics, people who gain eternity by martyrdom. Is that worrisome enough for you to drive policy here or in Israel?
So I think the main thing that we have to worry about with regard to Iran is its desire to be the hegemonic power in the Middle East, its desire to reestablish the old Persian Empire. That's what they want to do. So all those things I talked about before, the terrorism they practice, the terrorism they support, the insurgencies they support, the reason they want a nuclear weapon, the reason they want Israel to go away, the reason they want to push us out of the region is so that they can be the power and call the shots. And that's what our Arab allies, Saudi Arabia, the United Arab Emirates, are pushing back against. And it's not, Hugh, it's not a Shia thing. It's not an Iranian thing. It's a Persian thing. It goes way back in Iranian history. The Shah wanted to do this. This is not just this supreme leader. This is deeply rooted in Iranian society.
But, you know, the Khomeiniist, I read the Persian Night by, I can't remember his name, but lots of Iranian stuff. And there is that Khomeiniist theology that wanted to erase everything Persian and make it Shia end times, 12th Imam stuff. That's not successful,
yeah, so not
in your
this
view?
Piece of it, right? Not this piece of it. Not the piece that says we should be, you know, we're the most important country in the region and we should be and
right.
We should be dominant. Now, there is no doubt about it, Hugh, that I think Islamic extremism began in 1979 with the overthrow of the Shah and the taking of the U.S. embassy. That's when this whole thing began, the whole kind of concept of violence for what they perceive to be religious purposes. This goes all the way back, I think, to Khomeini and his revolution.
Now, let me talk a little bit about the presidents you've served. First of all, as to George W. Bush, you found him a normal guy, informal and approachable. His father is very funny. He makes a cameo on page 25 because former presidents get briefed if they want. He came into a briefing with 43. After a bit, he gets up and leaves. Says, "I've done this before. I'm going to play with the grandkids." But these are just men, right? These are men that have to cope. I don't know how anyone does this.
There's no doubt in my mind. It's the hardest job in the world. There are very few people think you're doing it well. Half the country likes you, half the country doesn't. And you only get the hardest problems, right? The easy stuff is long, long gone by the time it comes into your office. So, you know, it is an extremely tough job.
Now, you say of the two presidents, President Bush sometimes acted too quickly. President Obama sometimes moves too slowly. Now, you didn't answer this question, though. Which is the greater problem in a president?
Yeah, so it's hard to say, right? Because everybody's different. Everybody has their own style. The value of taking a little bit longer is you get more information, you get more input. The cost of waiting a little longer is, you know, maybe you wait too long. So, I'm not sure there's a right or wrong, and I'm not just, dodging the question. I'm not sure it's right or wrong. I will tell you one thing. I learned something very important from Bill Casey when he was the director. I was a very young analyst, but I used to hear him say over and over again, you know, a bad decision is better than no decision. You know, a quick decision is better than no decision. So certainly, you know, no decision is bad. But I don't want to really say which is better, right? Waiting a little bit longer or moving too quickly.
Did you ever meet Bill Casey, by the way?
I never met him. I just, you know, listened to him, you know, speak to the troops.
Yeah, my parish in Washington in 83 through 89 was, I think it's called Blessed Sacrament, up near the vice president's house.
Sure, sure.
And that's Casey's parish. And he showed up one time to a talk I was giving. I have never been so intimidated in my life as when I had Bill Casey in the back of the room listening to me talk about something or other. You write about the 9/11 commission saying, and my buddy, my boss from the White House here is Fred Fielding, was on that. So I have to tread carefully here. The 9/11 attacks resulted from a failure of imagination. You reject this very forcefully, quote, imagination without substantial facts to back it up has never been and will never be the basis for policy decisions, nor should it be.
Right.
Can you explain that to people?
Yeah, so I've never bought this idea that you know, the intelligence community and the policy community never imagined, right, what was possible on 9/11, and if we somehow had imagined it, it wouldn't have happened. It's ridiculous. And the story I tell in the book is, look, if I had walked into the president's office, the Oval Office, and I had said, Mr. President, my analysts can imagine the following, that 19 guys are going to train themselves on how to fly aircraft, not take off, not land, but how to fly aircraft. They're going to do it secretly in the United States. They're going to get box cutters through security and airport. They're going to take over aircraft using those box cutters. They're going to break into cockpits because the cockpit doors aren't what they should be. And they're going to take over the planes, not to hijack them, but to actually crash them into buildings to use them as missiles in an attack on the United States. I think he would have said, Michael, that's really nice, and I'm sure your analysts can imagine a lot of things, but what I really want to know is, what is Al-Qaeda planning? So would you please get me some intelligence?
Yeah, it's a very well argued piece, and that part. By the way, this is a daily thing. You didn't do this on Sundays, did you?
No. But 6 days a week.
6 days a week, and you do it after the vice president's been in there, and the vice president attends most of these briefings.
Yes.
I wanted
to
ask you about Scooter Libby, for whom I have a lot of admiration. He plays a role in the book, the Great War of Our Time, pushing for you guys to find a connection between Al Qaeda and Saddam.
Yeah.
Ultimately, you don't. And I was saying to myself, he's doing his job and you did yours because he made you. You're quite able to write today with certainty there was no connection because Scooter Libby pushed you that hard. Isn't that fair?
Well, yes and no. So absolutely, it is the right, even the responsibility of policymakers to push, right? And, you know, nobody pushed harder in asking really, really good questions than the vice president. And let me tell you something right up front. I've met a lot of politicians in my day. Nobody cared more about the security of the country than Vice President Cheney. Nobody. So absolutely, they had a right to push and ask questions. And what I think is the vice president and Scooter Libby, on behalf of the vice president, really worried about there being a connection, you know, deeply concerned about there being a connection between a country that's got weapons of mass destruction and an enemy, Al-Qaeda, that has already attacked us in the homeland. So they had every reason to deeply worry about a possible connection there and to push us on it. Absolutely right. But once we made a call, Hugh, I thought Scooter Libby went too far in telling us to withdraw it because it was wrong.
All right. Some free range questions here. Do you read spy novels or do they get in the way? Like, I have Daniel Silva, Brad Thor, Alex Berenson. I used to have the late Vince Flynn on every time they wrote a book. Do you read them?
No, I don't, because, you know, because I know what's kind of true, right? And so I don't, I have to tell you.
You talk sports with various people in this book as you pass the time. Are you a Redskins fan?
So, you know, I started out as a Browns fan. I grew up in Cleveland.
Hey, that's what I was getting to. I was going to call you on because I'm from Warren, Ohio, and I was going to call you.
Oh, man. That's great.
Yeah, so
I started out as a Browns fan, but when they moved to Baltimore and there was no team left in Cleveland, you know, I started becoming a Ravens fan. So I'm a Browns, Ravens, Redskins fan.
This might not, that might, that goes to credibility of the deputy director of the CIA. He rooted for the Ravens. Oh, that's terrible. The airplane travel, I mean, you're on it for hours and hours. How do you pass the time?
So I pass the time, right, by preparing for the next briefing. So there's a secure communications capability, right, on Air Force One. And I pass the time by reading materials that my guys would send to me and prepare, or just read novels or watch movies. I remember, this is not in the book, but I remember watching Caddyshack with President Bush coming back from a trip to China.
Have you met the Dalai Lama? Do you have that going for you?
Pardon?
Have you met the Dalai Lama? That's a line in the Caddyshack.
No, I haven't.
Okay, so you haven't got that going for you.
But I have to tell you, it's tough to watch Caddyshack with a president because you don't know if you should laugh at certain points until you make sure he's laughing.
Well, I also was impressed with the description of operational security around the bin Laden raid. And you had to drop your CAPS tickets off at the gate for your wife, and you couldn't make the last choral performance at visitation prep. You were close to a divorce, but she understood afterwards.
Yeah, it was a good thing the president decided to tell the American people that night, or it would have been hell for me.
All right, you were also in London. One of your many jobs was to be our liaison in Great Britain, MI5, MI6, on the day of 7/7, their terrible attack. And on page 120, you write this, and I think it's so necessary for the American people to read this. 12 hours after those attacks killed 57, you got on a British bus, quote, "This was just 12 hours after a suicide bomber had blown up an identical vehicle fewer than 2.5 miles away. Yet the bus was full and no one seemed nervous. No one was eyeing the other passengers suspiciously. This was the legendary British keep calm and carry on attitude at work, born of surviving the Blitz by Hitler and hundreds of IRA bombings over the years." Do you think we have enough of that in this country, Mike Morrell?
No, we don't at all, right? There's a sense among the American people that the government should be able to stop every attack. And that's, you know, that's an impossible bar to meet. In any war, there are battles you're going to win, and there are battles you're going to lose. And some of those battles are going to be attacks right here in the homeland. And Americans need to understand that, and that's one of the things I hope that comes across from exactly the story that you read. Because the British people understand that. The British people understand that you can have some successful attacks, and you can still win the war.
What do you think now, the people listening who are young, who should want to go to work for the CIA?
So I want people to want to go to work for the CIA who are absolutely passionate about the security of their country and who are willing to work incredibly hard, long hours, live overseas, some pretty nasty places, in order to do really interesting work to protect the country. That's who I want.
Was it fair in your view to convict these contractors recently who got in the gunfight and killed some innocents in Iraq?
These are the Blackwater guys?
Right.
Yeah, I mean, so Hugh, they went well beyond what they should have done. There was some significant poor judgment there, negligence. So, yeah, I think probably it was the right outcome.
One of the advantages of reading The Great War of Our Time is that you clearly are nonpartisan, but you also, no one can believe we went to war for oil or for Halliburton or for domination after you read this. But yet we need to get that message out for your de-radicalization prescription to work, right?
Yeah, on this question of nonpartisan, somebody asked me the other day, you know, are you auditioning in this book, right, to come back in a future administration? And I laughed and I said, look, I criticized Republicans on Benghazi, I criticized Democrats on enhanced interrogation techniques, and I criticized myself in a whole bunch of places. So no, this is not an audition.
But what about the you do talk about the need to de-radicalize, the hardest part of the war. Does it help our efforts when we have the fringe on both the far right and the far left spinning these bizarre theories of what happened? Because what I love about your book is it's just the way it is. People try to do their best. Sometimes they get caught up in the partisanship like the Feinstein Committee. But most of the time on the day-to-day basis, the people at the pointy end of the spear are trying to keep Americans alive.
You know, and that's true of almost everybody that we're talking about here. And I would even put Senator Feinstein in that camp. I think that every single person that I worked with, senior level person, senior policymakers, politicians, presidents, vice presidents, that everybody wanted to do the right thing for the country. You know, and go back to that sort of Iraq al-Qaeda story about the vice president, right? It was his passion for protecting the country that led him to push so hard and led Scooter to go over the line a little bit, right? And so everybody was trying to do the right thing. And one of the reasons I wrote the book is because I wanted people to know that CIA, at least, it is an organization that gets many, many, many things right, but it gets some things wrong, like any organization. You know, we're not perfect, but we're not horrible. And people are just trying to do their job. And when something doesn't go quite right, it's not because somebody screwed up on purpose, or it's not because somebody's intent was bad. It's just because the world is the way the world is.
Now, I want to finish by telling you about Benghazi. And you have quite an extensive, detailed note here. I am actually not one of those people who care much about the talking points. I actually didn't know any of this back and forth. I didn't know you'd been impugned.
Because, probably bored you then.
Well, I went through it thinking to myself, that's not the issue. The issue is, what did the president know, and when did he know, and what did he do it? What did the Secretary of State know, and when did she know, and what did she do it? Not what happened over at CIA between you and Petraeus and everyone. I always thought you guys were kind of feeding information as best you could, and you weren't helping the White House cover up, but that they may have been acting politically where they ought to have been acting as leader of the free world and the Secretary of State. What did you make of the Secretary of State having a private server in her house?
So I don't think that was a very good judgment. I don't know who gave her that advice, but it was not good advice. You know, she's paying a price for it now. It was not good.
As a professional matter, do you believe that at least one or perhaps many foreign intelligence services have everything that went to and from that server?
So I think that foreign intelligence services, the good ones, have everything on any unclassified network that the government uses, whether it's a private server or a public one. They're that good.
So that's a yes.
Yep.
The most interesting page in this book is when the Libyan intelligence chief attempts to convert you to Islam.
You like that?
I do. You know, that's good writing, by the way. I don't know Bill Harlow, who helped you with this, but he's very good.
Yeah. He's terrific.
He's terrific. And so I'll close this way. You worked for Tenet, Goss, Michael Hayden, Leon Panetta. By the way, great portrait of Panetta. I want to interview
Thanks.
Him. David Petraeus, and you worked alongside of Mr. Brennan. Who's the closest to George Smiley?
Oh, gosh. Probably Tenet. Great personality. Absolutely great personality. Great to be around. Taught me a tremendous amount. Deep respect for him.
And the thinking. But George Smiley was wheels within wheels within wheels, right? Is that George
yes.
Tenet?
Yes, yes.
And then I always ask people involved in the war, did the invasion of Iraq lead, in your judgment, to Libya's giving up the WMD? Berlusconi said it did, but what do you think?
Oh, I think so. I think so. Let me take that back. So I think there's multiple explanations. One explanation is that, yes, he was concerned that we would ultimately do to him what we did to Saddam. But I think there was a bigger issue. I think Gaddafi came to realize that as long as he was going down the path of WMD, and in particular nuclear weapons, that his country was going to go nowhere. And I think he started to realize what his legacy was going to be in terms of the horrible economy and the horrible society that he was going to leave his people. So I think it was really kind of the combination of the two. As he matured, as he got older, and he started thinking about his legacy, he said, this is not what I want it to be.
But it's a nightmare now. Well, I mean, I guess this is again, it's unfair. It's hypothetical. Would you do now if you'd known then? But thank God for El-Sisi. And I say that, my Egyptian friends get mad at me because he's not Mr. Human Rights. But the Saudis and the Egyptians and the Jordanians are getting their act together against ISIS and the Iranians. And Libya is becoming their fallback state, isn't it?
Yes, it is. Libya is a mess, right? Libya is awash with extremists. I think you probably saw the part of the book where when Sisi overthrew Morsi, that
yep.
one of the Arab ambassadors in Washington called me and said, what do you think? And I said, this is a great day for Egypt,
yep.
right? He's going to save Egypt, which wasn't the politically correct answer in Washington at the time. I think we've now come around, and we're now being fully supportive of President Sisi. You talked about the radicalization problem earlier. You know, he and King Abdullah Jordan are really leading the way and starting to have a conversation with their people about this whole question of violence and Islam and their society. So I think that's really, really important.
And does the country, America, get the Muslim Brotherhood yet after reading? I always send people to read The Looming Terror by Lawrence Wright so they can understand Ketub and the rest of it.
Book. It's a great book.
Do you think we understand the brothers?
I mean, I think CIA does. I think the U.S. government does. I don't think the American people do, because I think there's been a portrait, right, drawn of them that they are only political, right? That it's only a political movement. But it is really more than that, right? They want to come to power not just through democratic means, but through any means that they can.
And a very last question. You're now working for Beacon Global Strategies. One of your partners is Philippe Rhines. Now, I have partners at my law firm, which is Aaron Fox, who are not, you know, they're left-wing Democrats, and I get along fine with them. Philippe is Hillary's guy. And so how's he like this book?
Yeah. So I don't know. He hasn't told me yet.
He may not be talking to you, actually.
Look, let me say a couple things about Beacon. I'm actually talking to you from Beacon right now. You know, all four of the partners, and there's four, Philippe is one, all four of the partners are public servants. They've served their country. Now, three of them tend to the left, and one of them tend to the right. Michael Allen is one of the partners. He was in George Bush's White House. He was Mike Rogers' staff director on the House Intelligence Committee. He was going to be Governor Romney's transition guy for the intelligence community. So, and if you look at our website here and all the advisors we have, you'll see a lot of political balance. So like any organization, right, there are people who tend one way and who tend another. And I think much too has been made of my joining the firm here, and what does that mean about Michael's future, and what does that mean about Michael's relationship with Hillary, and you know, it at the end of the day, it's all nonsense, and I kind of ignore it. And
I'm just asking because I'm thinking about sending you a resume because I like the book so much. I think I'd like to work for you, Michael Morell. This is a great work and a very great public service. I hope everybody reads it. Thanks for spending so much time with me.
You're welcome. Great to be with you.
Take care.